Good afternoon and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. We have a very large audience today. I know that many of you are here because you've heard our guest, Ilan Berman, before. You heard him here in April. Before we get to Ilan, this is your JPC commercial. We were established in 1985 as a 501c3 organization, providing analysis of both foreign and domestic policies. That is analysis of policy, not analysis of politics. You can find us on our website at jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can read our insight articles, our magazine In Focus Quarterly, and our blog In Context. As you can see, we have a pattern. We support a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. That last one is really hot right now. In this series of calls, we've been very pleased to bring you scholars and policymakers on issues including China, China in Hong Kong, China in the Middle East, China as a security issue between the United States and Israel, and yes, we do things other than China. We have done Israeli sovereignty in Judea and Samaria, the Abraham Accords, Iran sanctions, what's been going on in Iran, and a side trip to the U.S. Supreme Court. Today, we're going back to Iran. Before we come to Ilan Berman, you get your public service announcement. Your microphones are muted, but you can send questions during the presentation by using the Q&A function on your Zoom screen. Do not please send emails to our email address, but use the Q&A function on your Zoom. Now to our program. Ilan Berman is Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C., an expert on regional security in the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Russian Federation. He has consulted to the CIA, as well as to the Departments of Defense and State. And he's provided assistance on foreign policy and national security to a range of government agencies and congressional offices. Ilan is a member of the Associated Faculty of Missouri State University's Department of Defense and Strategic Studies. A frequent writer and commentator, he has been seen in the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, the New York Times, Foreign Policy, the Washington Post, and USA Today, among others. He's the author of several books, including Iran's Deadly Ambition, Tehran Rising, Iran's Challenge to the United States, my personal favorite, which is called Implosion, the End of Russia and What It Means for America. And he has a new book out. In fact, it is so new that I didn't know it was here. Please look into Ilan Berman's The Fight for Iran, Opposition Politics, Protest, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Nation, which is what I think he's going to talk about. Ilan, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you, Shoshana. And I do appreciate the book plug. I chalk up the fact that you weren't informed about it based upon the idea that I have terrible marketing skills and I didn't get the word out in time. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about if I get a chance to, about Iranian opposition politics, sort of where we stand. But, you know, I think what's necessary first is to set the scene. And I'm frankly delighted that we're doing this just a few days before the election, because although you lead and I lead on foreign policy issues when we think about national politics, the reality is that most voters tend to rank foreign policy very low on their hierarchy of needs, sort of when they go to the ballot box, when they pull the lever, when they circle in the box, the bubble. I think that's important now because although in this cycle, foreign policy has had commensurately a greater reach and a greater resonance than it has before, it's still very much a second order issue or a third tier issue. Even though if you voted on foreign policy, the distinctions between the two candidates, between President Trump and his Democratic challenger, Vice President Joe Biden, are very, very stark. And I would argue probably the most most significant divergence of potential strategy actually has to do with Iran, right? Hence the title of the talk, the sort of the idea that our policy towards Iran is at a crossroads. So I'm going to get there in a minute. But what I think is necessary to lay out first is sort of where we are, right? You sort of have to know where you are in order to know where you're going. So you may not know it from the way this has been covered in the press over the last 3 months, because it is the silly season here in Washington. But maximum pressure on Iran is working, right? Empirically speaking, in terms of quantifiable data that you can see, that you can register economic patterns. The Iranian regime, which still relies on oil revenue for a significant portion of its GDP, has seen, since the advent of maximum pressure in May of 2018, has seen its oil revenue plummet by over 90%. Last year, they plummeted from, $30 billion all the way down to $8 billion. And earlier this month, the chairman of the Iran-China Chamber of Commerce, which is apparently a thing, we'll talk about China in a second, said in a public interview to a state news agency that by his estimates, Iran will clear at best $5 billion this year as a result of oil sales abroad, right? And that's a reflection of the fact that the market is cooling, the fact that there are countries that were previously eager consumers of Iranian oil and natural gas that are increasingly skittish. They're worried about entangling with the Iranian regime and the potential consequences that are likely to accrue from unilateral U.S. sanctions. But the oil revenue sort of is not the end of the story. Foreign direct investment into Iran has dried up as well. Earlier this year, the UN estimated that by its calculation, foreign investment in Iran has shrunk by over a quarter over the last year, and it now stands at its lowest level in two decades. The Iranian national currency, the rial, has cratered, and it's forced the regime to pump massive amounts of cash on the order of $24, $25 billion to date, funneled through the Iranian central bank into the national economy to stabilize the currency. And when there's trouble in the markets, there tends to be trouble in the streets. So what you're seeing is concomitant with that economic decline that is being driven by external maximum pressure, you're seeing a rise of domestic discontent. The same protest that you saw in December, that started in December of 2017, that have sort of continued sporadically throughout, that chilled momentarily, temporarily, as a result of the coronavirus, they're back. And you see them in in significant urban centers throughout the Islamic Republic. But in this particular case, it's about ideology, it's about governance, but really it's about the sort of this vote of no confidence in the regime. The regime is not weathering the current political situation well. The regime is also, you know, last time we talked about how the regime is not weathering the pandemic well. That, I think that's still the case very much, but it's also not weathering international pressure well, despite the fact that Iranian officials put on a brave face when they give speeches and when they give media commentary. The consequence of this, though, right? So for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And the reaction from the Iranian regime has been an end to its strategy of what used to be called strategic patience, right? The idea that the Iranian regime had for a long time, and it was an idea that was frankly cultivated and fed by people like former Secretary of State John Kerry, was that you can simply wait out Trump, that maximum pressure may be bad, but Trump is a one-termer and, you know, just hold on and sort of, you know, relief is coming. That's I would argue, maybe a slightly uncharitable way to put it, but that was the message that was received in Tehran. And the Iranians, for a long time, that was the strategy they pursued. You saw them begin to inch out of the 2015 nuclear deal, to begin to violate provisions of the nuclear deal, but they didn't rip up the accord altogether because they understood that they didn't want to do something irrevocable that would actually amplify maximum pressure. But the worse their internal economic situation has become, the more desperate they've become. And that's the proper context, I think, to think about the $400 billion, 25-year strategic accord that the Iranians signed with the People's Republic of China earlier this year, right? Just this summer. That accord encompasses everything from telecom cooperation, right? From the sort of China, Chinese national tech champions like Huawei coming into the Islamic Republic, to Chinese construction of port facilities, to frankly, a very significant erosion of Iranian national sovereignty. And when I read the parameters of the accord, and the draft accord sort of has been very helpfully leaked from Iran in Farsi, it translated into English, you can find it sort of floating around the internet. The impression you come away with is this idea that the Iranian regime has come to the conclusion that they're in a lot of trouble, and they'd much rather be in charge of a smaller, weaker, less sovereign Islamic Republic than not to be in charge at all. And that's sort of the context of the deal that was struck between Beijing and Tehran this summer. It's also, frankly, at least informs some of the thinking that surrounds the current state of play at the United Nations. Earlier this year, the Trump administration embarked upon a fairly significant diplomatic initiative to try to extend the UN arms embargo. The context here is, as a sort of parallel with the passage of, or with the adoption of the JCPOA in 2015, previous resolutions in the UN constraining Iranian purchases of high-tech conventional arms were sort of, you know, solidified. And the idea was that, you know, if you're preventing Iran from pursuing on the nuclear path, you don't want to make it easier for them to pursue conventional weaponry, right? So sort of to enhance their military. Except baked into the provisions of the JCPOA was that some of these parallel agreements, parallel understandings, begin to expire before the JCPOA ever does. And one of them is the UN arms embargo. The resolutions governing prohibitions on the sale of advanced weaponry to Iran actually expired about a week and a half ago. And the reason that's significant is because it should be, frankly, a no-brainer for the international community to understand that providing Iran with access to advanced weaponry would amplify Iranian regional adventurism, would actually make the threat from Iran that everybody on both sides of the political aisle here and across the Atlantic are trying to stop, would make it more difficult to do so. And yet the Trump administration ran into some very significant political pressure and ultimately its effort to prevent this resumption of conventional arms commerce with Iran fell flat. The UN arms embargo was not extended. Frankly, that was, I would argue, a big part of that was Russia and China, because Russia and China have permanent seats on the Security Council and also happen to be the very countries that Iran would turn to and has historically turned to for advanced conventional weaponry. So if you saw obstructionism from Moscow, obstructionism from Beijing, frankly, it's just good business for them to do that. But the end result was that the Trump administration has resorted to an intensification of maximum pressure, right? The so-called snapback mechanism in which it has unilaterally reimposed a lot of, not all, but a lot of the sanctions that pre-existed the JCPOA. And now the rub is we have to implement it, right? And this brings us to where we are today and where we're going to be in about a week, because we're really sort of approaching a really interesting fork in the road when it comes to Iran policy. On the one hand, the Trump administration, if it's reelected for a second term, if the president's reelected for a second term, I think it's almost a guarantee that what you'll see is an intensification, a further intensification of maximum pressure for very simple reasons. The president has said publicly that he thinks that if he wins, if the Iranians understand that strategic patience doesn't work, that they're stuck with him for another 4 years, they will rush to the negotiating table because they understand that over time, the amount of economic and political pressure that's being levied on their regime is not sustainable for them, right? It's either talk or go out of business. And so I think it's a pretty safe bet to assume that even whether or not the president is reelected, certainly if the president is reelected into his second term, you'll see an intensification of maximum pressure. If he's not reelected, I think you're going to see an intensification of maximum pressure over the next several months in an attempt by the administration to put things in motion that'll be difficult for the incoming administration to reverse, to go back to the status quo that existed before. But certainly, if there's a second Trump term, I think it's a safe bet to assume that maximum pressure would be intensified. And it may be, the president may be correct. It may compel the Iranian regime, despite the fact that they have no desire to do so, to come back to the negotiating table to negotiate out an agreement that's more broadly consistent with U.S. national security principles. Then the rub becomes, you know, what does that agreement actually look like? How do we shape the contours of that agreement? But there's also another alternative future, which is that, on the issue of Iran, the Biden campaign has been very outspoken. It's been very outspoken for a simple reason, because quite a few of the advisors that have surrounded, and are surrounding the former vice president were present at the formulation of the 2015 nuclear deal. In fact, the vice president has talked about it on the campaign trail as sort of a badge of honor that he was in the room during the creation of the JCPOA. And he signaled that what he wants to do very broadly is to deconflict with Iran, to sort of to ratchet down the tensions that almost certainly is going to be reflected in a diminution of U.S. sanctions, a reduction of maximum pressure. And it may even be more than that. It may be a sort of a blueprint, a roadmap to re-engagement with Iran. In fact, in August, just a couple of months ago, the Center for a New American Security, which has quite a few Biden advisors sort of on its roster of experts, put out what it called a blueprint for diplomacy with Iran, right? Sort of ratchet down tensions, or re-engage, de-escalate with Iran. And it's, I think, an important document for the viewers to read if they haven't read it, because I think it gives you a sense of what a first term Biden Iran policy would look like. If I've read it, I can assure you that sort of Iranian officials have read it as well. And I think that's sort of what they're anticipating is going to come out. That doesn't mean unequivocally that they think that life will be categorically better under a Biden administration. But I think on balance, they think that the things that they're worried about in the here and now, maximum pressure, solvency of the Iranian regime, internal stability, the pressure comes off at least a little bit with the advent of a Biden administration. And by the way, they're acting along those prerogatives, right? You don't have to believe me. You can sort of listen to the statements that are coming out of the National Counterintelligence Center, which director of which, William Evanina, talked last month and also talked back in August about the fact that countries like China and Iran are actively interfering for different, very different reasons, actively interfering in the U.S. election or attempting to. From the Iranian context, when Evanina talked about this, and he's sort of amplified on those remarks since, he stressed the fact that what Iran was trying to do was to increase societal tensions, to sort of increase discord, because it anticipates that more discord will lead to a more fundamental political transition than one that exists without it, right? By the way, this is all sort of a little bit inside baseball. And if you talk to any professionals who monitor election interference and foreign engagement in the U.S. electoral cycle, they'll be the first to tell you that it's a matter of scale, right? Russia and China and Iran can interfere. The question really is, can they interfere on a scale that actually makes a difference on election day and thereafter? The answer seems to be no, but the fact that Iran is engaged in this process, even as it weathers economic crises, as it weathers domestic crises, even that it's engaged in this initiative at that time, suggests to me at least that they, at the very least, have picked winners and losers in terms of the U.S. election, and they have a clear preference for what they want. So I think that's a good place to stop. I think what's useful to understand is that neither course is fundamentally problem-free. If there is an intensification of maximum pressure in a second Trump term, there's all sorts of problems that flow from that as well, and we can talk about them in the Q&A. If there is a de-escalation under Biden, that's a completely different set of problems and set of challenges that are going to confront the U.S. national security establishment.
Sorry, I keep forgetting to unmute myself. We will go to Q&A. We have lots of good questions. Let me remind everybody first that Elon Berman is the author of a new book, The Fight for Iran, Opposition Politics, Protest, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Nation. And I say that not only to boost book sales for Elon Berman, but because it relates to the first question. So you have talked about how much weaker the Iranian regime is now than it was before, and how maximum pressure really has had an impact. So I'm going to try to group some of these questions together. The first question is, How much weaker would it need to be before we could imagine the people rising up and overthrowing it? It's the first question. And with that question goes the question, then what? How good a fix do we have on what will come after the Ayatollahs? And how good are we at managing people's regime change? Even if we don't do it, I am not suggesting the United States enter Iran, but it's conceivable that the Iranian people will take this into their own hands.
Right. So no, great questions. And let me start with the back and sort of work my way forward. So the answer is not very, right? We're not very confident about what comes next. And there's a reason for that. First of all, right, historically, it bears saying that we are generally not good at regime change. We're not. By the way, I do not endorse his political policies, but the political scientist Stephen Kinzer has a book called Overthrow from a few years ago, in which he essentially cataloged the, at that time, 16 different cases of U.S. post-Cold War interventionism and how they turned out. And the record, charitably, is not great in terms of intended and unintended consequences. So that's something to think about. The other thing to think about is that to cycle back to May of 2018, when the president made the decision to remove, to sort of abrogate the JCPOA, to remove the United States from the JCPOA, there was a lot of questions that swirled at the time about, you know, to what end? What is the goal that we're trying to accomplish? And I would argue that at that time, at least, there was three different approaches that were being pursued simultaneously by the administration. The first was the 12 preconditions approach that Secretary Pompeo laid out in that speech the same month at the Heritage Foundation, in which he talked about how Iran needed to change behavior on everything from military forces in Syria to greater transparency on its nuclear program as a prerequisite for normalized relations with the United States. At the time, and still, I held the view that this was a list that was frankly unachievable by Iran, because if Iran did everything America wanted to do, it would be tantamount to capitulation and Iran wouldn't be a revolutionary regime anymore. But maybe that was the point. Maybe that was sort of the intent of what we were trying to do. But nonetheless, a very hefty bill of particulars about sort of the criteria that Iran would have to satisfy. The second path of sort of the middle way was what the president articulated about Iran coming back to the negotiating table, applying so much economic pressure that Iran would come back to the negotiating table and hammer out a deal, not because it wants to, but because it's compelled to do so by economic realities. And the third approach, at least at that time, was the approach that was articulated by then National Security Advisor John Bolton, which he talked about regime collapse, not regime change, mind you, but regime collapse, meaning that we could apply so much pressure to the Islamic Republic that the regime would essentially collapse from within. And because the regime is a malign actor in the region, that wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing. And I like to keep that in my mind as I think about sort of what may come next, because it is not an assured outcome that if there's a second Trump term and maximum pressure intensifies, the Iranians come back to the negotiating table, right? Another alternative future is that we apply so much pressure that the regime comes down. And then the question becomes, what if we're the dog that catches the car? What comes next, right? And we frankly have not spent nearly enough time examining the different strains of the Iranian opposition, right? We all know a little bit about them. We all know a little bit about Marxists and monarchists and sort of, you know, not so much about the folks in between. So my book, right, this is the shameless plug. My book was essentially an attempt to explore that, right? And it was essentially just these case studies of these different movements, some of which are focused on human rights, some of which are focused on constitutionalism and sort of redrafting the constitution of Iran to look at religiously based, to sort of to be a secular democracy. All of them have tremendous ideas, but the unifying thread is that the whole is less than the sum of its parts, meaning there's fantastic ideas. There's no cohesion among these movements. There's really no unifying thread, unifying glue that holds them together, which is why it's very difficult to think about a post-theocratic future in Iran. We may want regime change in Iran. We may want the Iranians to take matters into their own hands and come to the streets. But we really don't have a good sense of what is likely to come about if they do that. If the protests that are happening sort of on the streets of Tehran and Isfahan and other cities, if they actually succeed, I think the U.S. government is not really comfortable that it knows what it's going to end up with. And I would argue that's a real problem. And we should be getting smart on the human terrain within Iran and getting smart very quickly.
So we tend to look at it as collapse or change or something really dramatic. There are two other possibilities that listeners have suggested, more like letting the air out of the tire. First of all, do you have any sense of the Ayatollah's health and possible remaining lifespan? Because what we may have is an internal change of power that does not collapse the government, but he's out, and whether that would matter. And the second one from a different reader is, listener, is what about the possibility of the Azeris of northern Iran deciding to join the Azeris of Azerbaijan and trying to change the borders of Iran?
Well, so both of those, I think, sort of are relating to that broad picture of opposition politics. I hate to sort of be a pessimist, Shoshana. You and I have known each other for a long time. You know that I'm a pessimist. But yeah, the reality is, to me, the likelihood of regime change in Iran, the most likely scenario, if regime change does come to pass, is precisely that sort of deflation, right? That sort of, and an internal change, not from theocrats to democrats, but from theocrats to authoritarians, right? So it's worth pointing out here that the most important strategic actor in Iran is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Iranian clerical army. They control something like a third of the national economy. They are a true deep state in sort of in the sort of classical sense of the word, where it's not just a military. They control the levers of power. They actually are the kingmakers. In fact, so much so that 10 years ago, my friend Ali Alfona, who at that time was at the American Enterprise Institute, wrote a whole book about it. And it's a book, the thesis was that, you know, the Ayatollahs are receding, the IRGC is advancing, and there is this quiet changeover that people aren't noticing that's happening in the Islamic Republic. His theory, I don't buy it for a whole host of reasons, at least not yet, but his theory was so influential at the time that it became literally the Iran policy of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Right. So people have been thinking about this for a long time. But I think, you know, history provides some good examples here. The IRGC is a ideological actor. It is a super empowered actor in the Iranian political system. But it's also an organization that wants desperately to remain in power. And so when it if it sees the thing coming down, if it sees this sort of this deflation of the tire, you could very well see a assumption of state prerogatives and state power by elements of the IRGC in a way in which we'd end up with a more secular, probably not totally secular, but a more secular, more predictable authoritarian regime headed by a military junta than what we have now. And then sort of the question becomes, you know, in the aggregate, would that be good for the United States or would it be bad or would it be indifferent? You know, that's a calculus for our national leaders to make, but the assumption that we go directly from theocracy to democracy, frankly, I think we miss quite a few options in the middle.
Yeah, a quick study of Iraq over the last 10 years would probably be helpful. again, in line with the maximum pressure campaign and the reduction of money available to the Islamic Republic, along with collapsing oil prices that is not due to them, but you know it reduces their money as well, we have seen, or have we seen, a reduction in their support of terrorism abroad is one question. Well, let's just go with that for the moment. Have we seen a reduction in, for example, support for Hezbollah, support for Hamas? And perhaps also, is this a reason that Iran has been very quiet about the Abraham Accords and about Israel's relationships in the Gulf region and now with Sudan and Africa?
Right. So the answer is yes, but. There's always a but. So I think it's absolutely correct to sort of to point out money is fungible. And the less money Iran has in aggregate, it all, of course, depends on the priorities of the Supreme Leader and the priorities of the Iranian leadership. But in the aggregate, if they have less money, they have less money to spend on things that we consider bad, like resistance movements such as Hezbollah. In fact, you're beginning to see that play out. Late last year, early this year, before the onset of the pandemic, Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's supreme guide, actually went on national television in Lebanon to ask for donations from the Hezbollah faithful, right? He was essentially doing a telethon. And the idea that Hezbollah, which receives hundreds of millions of dollars historically from Iran on a yearly basis, would have to resort to that, suggests to me, and probably to several other people, that Hezbollah is having, there's something changing. There's something changing in the dynamic, in sort of the patron-client dynamic. And I would argue, I would expect that if Hezbollah, which is the crown jewel in Iran's threat network, is having these problems, less significant proxies, such as Yemen's Houthi rebels, such as Shiite militias in Iraq, are having the same thing, having sort of the same circumstance. So that's the good news. The bad news is this is a rolling process, right? There will, depending on how significantly the Iranians prioritize this non-state actor network, this sort of this threat network that they've built around the Middle East, it's very likely that the threat network will remain significantly well-funded, even though the regime itself is experiencing some pretty large economic turbulence. But that's the context, I think, to think about when we think about Iran's reaction or non-reaction to the Abraham Accords. The Iranians have said publicly, you know, we oppose this. We think it's a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. We think Sudan, the latest statement from a couple of days ago was, we think Sudan had to pay a ransom to get off the U.S. foreign terrorism list. But the reality is the Iranians also understand something profound is happening in the region, that there is this coalescence of a coalition which around Israel and around sort of, you know, the Gulf Arab monarchies. But that coalition is inherently anti-Iranian, right? It was a coalition that was founded based upon shared concerns over a nearly nuclear Iran. And those ties from there blossomed out into economic contacts and technological and, you know, innovation contacts. But the crux of it, the core of it, was always a shared resistance to Iran. So the idea that this alliance in the making, this sort of this regional bloc in the making, is beginning to harden, it's beginning to sort of, you know, to stand up on its own right, has to be significantly concerning for Iran, especially at a time when Iran is looking at a diminished economic future, when it can't push back the way its leaders undoubtedly want to.
So you said magic words, which is almost nuclear Iran. Any idea when they will be nuclear? The IAEA had another negative report on Iran this week saying that they are rebuilding plants that were destroyed by somebody. We don't know who did that, but somebody did it. Somebody. How close are they? And is that one of the priorities for their money?
So the answer is, I don't know, but closer, right? I think it's reasonable to conclude based upon the readings of the International Atomic Energy Agency, based upon the readings of organizations that monitor this stuff, like the Institute for Science and International Security here in Washington, that the threshold for Iran to sort of the breakout capability, the window, has shrunk, right? It used to be measured in years. It's now measured in months. I think from the latest report last month, the estimate was that Iran now needs 3.5 months to sort of just sprint to the nuclear finish line, which is significantly less time than existed before, significantly less time than existed in 2015. When the JCPOA was concluded, which tells you something about regime priorities. Because if the international understanding, right, it's not a treaty, it's not a pact because it wasn't signed, but if the international understanding that is the JCPOA was intended to derail Iran's nuclear development, at least temporarily, at least for a decade, you have to conclude based upon that assessment that it hasn't been totally successful because Iran is still making progress, slower progress, but still progress towards a nuclear finish line. And that really throws the conversation back on the United States, right? Every president has said consistently that Iran will not go nuclear on their watch. President Trump has said it. President Obama said it before him. President Bush said it before him. And they've all been right so far, right? Empirically, they've been correct. Right. But at a certain point, Iran will reach a stage where its nuclear development is so advanced that it does not become the next president's problem. And the more we think about that in the here and now, frankly, the better off we would be.
Okay, let's follow that with, is this where we talk about Israel and possibly talk about the American decision to supply Israel with bunker buster bombs, which they have sought since the Bush administration, the Bush 43 administration. And the United States has never been willing to sell those bombs to Israel. Now, in the wake of the F-35 sale to the UAE, it's not this for that, but as it happens, following on the F-35 agreement with the UAE, the United States is going to sell those bombs. If presidents have a tendency to kick this can down the road, the Israelis don't do it that way. It's not like you could get past this administration. Do we expect them to do something about it?
I think we always have in the back of our minds sort of the hope that Israel will solve our pesky Iran problem, right? And we've had this sort of this conversation for a long time, right? In Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. But I actually think the sort of the UAE bunker buster, UAE F-35 bunker buster conversation is about something different. It's about Israel's qualitative military edge, which you've written about, I've written about, right? The idea is that Israel is guaranteed by the United States to have a qualitative advantage over quantitatively superior Arab adversaries, right? And so the problem, the inherent problem with QME that you've had in recent years is with the proliferation of increasingly sophisticated defense technology globally, it becomes harder to preserve QME. And it becomes even harder to preserve QME when countries like the United Arab Emirates come to Washington and ask for very advanced technology. So I read the bunker buster sale as an effort at balancing between providing the Emiratis with very advanced fighter jets and maintaining the commitment to qualitative military edge that we made to the Israelis. This is germane to the Iran conversation also, because the not totally unintended side effect is that Iran is increasingly capable of unilateral military action to denuclearize. Israel is increasingly capable of unilateral military action to denuclearize Iran. And I think that has not gone unnoticed. And it's revived precisely this conversation, which is, can Israel be expected, can it be counted on to take matters into its own hands if the United States reverts back to this sort of re-engagement policy with the Islamic Republic?
So we have to have a QME conversation. We're not going to have it here. But the only thing I would say is that when you look at QME and you sell something to one side of the equation, the idea was that you would sell an offsetting thing to the other side to prevent the UAE from using its F-35s against Israel. And bunker busters just don't go there. So even if, and I don't think they will, but even if the UAE were to join a coalition of Arab countries, which is what the QME is designed to protect Israel from, bunker busters are not responsive to that. So I really think what they've done is they've given Israel something Israel wanted for a really long time, not to counter F-35s, but to say, yes, but you're our friend too.
Yes.
We're going to see how that works. But speaking about countries that are and are not friends, because there's always got to be a segue in these things. Two countries, one China that we do talk about here in this program every week, but the other, North Korea. Iran signed a deal with North Korea, 25-year deal with North Korea for North Korea to supply Iran with missiles. Now, is that just public recognition of something that's been ongoing? Is there a new relationship between North Korea and Iran, and should we worry about it? And then I'll do China, we'll wrap with China.
Okay, fine. So the answer is, it's public recognition of something that's been going on for a long time. 5 years ago, when the JCPOA was signed, myself and a number of sort of other folks who deal with Iran around town spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill, sort of trying to contextualize for members of Congress in different committees exactly what happened and exactly sort of what the contours and what the implications are. And one of the hearings I testified in actually had to do with Iran, North Korea, because one of the threads that got pulled as a result of the JCPOA discussion was that, you know, if there are constraints on Iran's procurement of ballistic missiles internationally, on Iran's procurement of advanced conventional weaponry, where could they get it? And North Korea very naturally rose to the top of that conversation. And I remember testifying at a hearing on Iran and North Korea before the House of Representatives, in which there was a pretty significant consensus among all the experts that were called to testify that this is a longstanding relationship. This is a relationship that absolutely revolves around ballistic missiles, very likely revolves around nuclear technology as well, right, based upon circumstantial evidence about Iranian engineers being present at North Korean nuclear tests and things like that. But it's a relationship that is poised to grow because as legitimate avenues for Iran are closed off as a result of the JCPOA, Iran will naturally shunt itself into illicit procurement and look more and more to suppliers like North Korea. And that's precisely what's happened over the last 5 years. You've seen a very significant uptick in Iranian procurement of dual-use technologies or of ballistic missile components from countries like North Korea, also from private entities in China, say. But the reason for that is very simple. This is something Iran still wants, and it's harder for Iran to get it on the open market because of the international restrictions that are now in place. So Iran is doing so clandestinely.
Okay, so raising China. China and Iran have suddenly become best buds, and Iran and Russia, and it's a little bit the same question between the two of them. China has a history of coming into countries and offering things on credit. And then when the country can't pay the bills to China, China acquires whatever the asset is. They've done it all over Africa with mines. They've done it with ports. Iran doesn't have money, real money, to give to China for any of these things. Are we likely to see Chinese bases in the Middle East at some point? Are we going to see China responsible for, I don't know, oil production facilities in Iran, since China imports all of its oil? And if you're Iran, how do you do this?
Right. Well, no, and you said the magic word, because Iran is not a strategic mineral rich country. Iran is an oil and natural gas rich country. And one of the most pronounced trend lines that you've seen, if you've sort of followed the Chinese economy over the last 10 years, has been the widening gap between energy, oil, natural gas, coal, other things that that China can produce domestically, indigenously, and its total demand, right? And so you get that huge disparity, right? That's what's propelling a lot of the port activity along the southern Persian Gulf and, you know, into the sort of the Pakistani shoreline and India and things like that, right? Iran is part of that conversation. And the Chinese are the sort of the term of art that you hear all the time is the Chinese are building a string of pearls, right? They're building a series of bases that are secure, that are defensible, that through which they can route their energy traffic because they understand they're not self-sufficient at home. And that's part of the Belt and Road. That's part of the maritime belt that is the signature initiative of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Iran is a big part of that conversation, both because Iran is a major oil and natural gas supplier, and also because through this confluence of economic and political circumstances, Iran is on the back foot. It's on the back foot in terms of its sovereignty. It's willing to cede some of its sovereignty to allow the Chinese to do precisely what you talked about, to establish an expeditionary presence, establish a sustainable industrial presence in Iran at the expense of its own sovereignty, because they'd much rather stay in business. And the end result is that you get new clients for Chinese tech giants like Huawei and ZTE, right? The sort of Iran's total population of 84.5 million people are, you know, very wired. They're very connected. This is not North Korea. They have cell phones, they have internet, right? So this is a good market for Chinese tech giants. It's also a very lucrative market potentially for this Chinese interest in energy development that you're beginning to see. And frankly, it's all because all politics are local and China has a growing demand at home and they need to feed it. And they have an Iran that is more than eager to supply.
And I think it should probably be said that America's allies in the Pacific also import energy from the Persian Gulf region. And China's interest in bases around Iran, in Gwadar, Pakistan, and the island chains could also be used to cut off supplies to our friends and allies. And so it seems to me that the Chinese, the Japanese and the Taiwanese and the South Koreans should be looking at all of this with tremendous concern. And I'm not sure they do, but they will one day. So we're approaching the end of our program, and it's always my goal to leave us on a high note. So the last thing I ask speakers to do before I pitch your book again, The last thing I ask speakers to do is give us some positive sign in the region that this could be going in our way, in our direction, or somebody might flip a switch and make it go in our direction. What's the good news?
With regard to Iran specifically?
Or the region, if you
okay, prefer. The region is an easier, I know that. Easier bill to
hit. All right, I'll let you off the hard one.
I am enormously heartened by the normalization wave that you're seeing in the region. Because it really, to me, it suggests something that was tactical in nature has become strategic, right? The tactical engagement that existed before was this shared concern over Iran, this shared sense that Washington was not listening under the Obama administration to the security concerns of the region, was empowering Iran, and all sorts of sort of malignant effects were coming as a result. I think those early conversations, they were necessary, but they also were the start of something that didn't have to become bigger, but it has, as we saw over the last several weeks. You now have normalization agreements with the UAE and Bahrain. You have a normalization agreement, frankly, that's much more of a peace deal between Israel and Sudan, because after all, Sudan was Sudan was famously, right, Khartoum was the site of the three no's and sort of no to normalization and all that. So, you know, that has, at least in symbolic terms, you know, a lot of resonance. And I also think that depending on what happens into the next several months, there's a sense that this is the start of something much bigger, right? Saudi Arabia is reportedly considering normalization, right? The extent of that, I think it remains to be determined. The Omanis are, the Moroccans are. But if they do break those relationships out into the open, it will just be a public confirmation of something that's already been happening privately. And that to me is, I think, the most profound, sort of the most profound change that's happening in the region. It's also a sense, it's also, frankly, a very big responsibility for whoever becomes president after our election. Because on the one hand, you know, the Trump administration can certainly take a bow for being the catalyst for all this to come out into the open. And now I would imagine that it wants to sort of to continue that momentum. But if it's it's a first Biden term, I think there's going to be a lot of eyes looking at the White House to make sure that what you've seen so far is not reversed, that there isn't a chill to this momentum as a result of political changes in Washington. And that to me is sort of going to dictate a tremendous amount of things in the Middle East.
So I gather from that you don't have an optimistic word to offer us on Iran itself, but I'll let you off. And as we close our program, ladies and gentlemen, please remember Ilan Berman, The Fight for Iran, Opposition Politics, Protest, and the Struggle for the Soul of a Nation. We will be off next week for election week, so you'll have to find something else to do. And we will be back with you sometime very soon. Ilan, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.